From WBUR in Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Bill Littlefield is away this week. There are just four Major League Baseball teams left in the postseason. Ahead on Only a Game, a league championship series update. And Jose Feliciano remembers his controversial performance of the national anthem at the 1968 World Series. Also, Helene Elliott previews the new NHL season. Also, meet the team that pulls its own weight and then some.
You can put a yoke on them a couple days after they're born. As they get older, you have to keep putting more weight behind them. You got to work on them every day. If you want to really compete with the big boys, there's a lot of time has to be put into them.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Bill Littlefield. With their victory last night in Game 2 of the National League Championship Series, the Philadelphia Phillies now lead the Los Angeles Dodgers 2-0. In the American League, the defending champion Boston Red Sox beat the Tampa Bay Rays 2-0 last night in Game 1 of the ALCS. Here to offer his usual thoughtful analysis of the playoffs is ESPN's Tim Kirkchin, who joins us on the line from Tampa. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Anthony?
Very well. It's good to have you. Let's start with the Rays-Red Sox game that you saw last night in Tampa. Daisuke Matsuzaka kept the Rays off balance most of the night. Was Tampa completely unprepared for his bag full of pitches?
No, they were totally prepared. But with Daisuke Matsuzaka, it doesn't matter if you're the most prepared team in the world. He comes with so much that if even when you are ready, he can beat you. And he was so good last night after a terrible first inning in which he almost gave up a bunch of runs. He didn't give up anything for the next five innings. And then it was a magician in the seventh inning in order to stop another rally. His stuff was really, really good last night. And even the Red Sox were just shaking their head about how good this guy can be, especially when he gets himself in trouble.
He always seems to pitch out of a jam, doesn't he?
He does. And Terry Francona looked at me after the game last night, and he said, "Look at the top of my head," which, of course, has no hair.
No hair at all.
And he blamed that mostly on Daisuke Matsuzaka.
Well, some folks have been waiting all year for the Rays to fail, but does losing one playoff game at home constitute failure?
Absolutely not. I mean, you look at this team. How many times this year did they lose a game, a couple of games, even seven games in a row, and everyone said, all right, that's it for that team. And yet they roared right back. And I fully expect them to do that again in this series. It doesn't matter. It's the playoffs now. This team is ready for anything. However, they really needed to win the game last night. They had their chances. They didn't get it done. And it's not a good omen when you don't win a game that you have every chance to win, especially when it's game one, especially when it's at home. But I repeat, this series isn't even close to being over or in deep trouble for the Rays.
Well, game two takes place tonight. It'll be Josh Beckett for the Sox against Scott Kazmir for the Rays. How do you think that game will play out?
Well, it's going to be real interesting to watch Josh Beckett. He, of course, is one of the five greatest postseason pitchers in the history of the sport. But if he continues to struggle, and Scott Kazmir, the starter for the Rays, pitches well, which he has not done a whole lot of lately, then suddenly the Rays are right back in this thing. So I can't wait to see which Josh Beckett shows up. If it's the good one, the Rays are in a lot of trouble.
Okay, let's move over to the National League. Philly starter Brett Myers helped his own cause by hitting a whole lot better than he pitched. He went 3-for-3 with three RBIs. He also got the win, pitching just five innings. I guess with a performance like that, his teammates didn't really need to show up.
You know, it was really amazing because Brett Myers is not a very good hitting pitcher. He only had five hits in the whole regular season, and then he gets three in a playoff game off a whole bunch of really good pitchers. So it's just the beauty of baseball where a guy that you just look at and say, well, he can't do any damage. He does as much damage as anyone. He runs the bases. And it was a great win for the Phillies, in part because now they're up 2-0, but because they kind of stole one from the Dodgers, because as good a hitter as they had was their pitcher.
Well, the Dodgers now find themselves down 2-0 as they head home. LA, of course, has a manager who knows how to guide a team through the playoffs. Do you think Joe Torre can help his team come back and win this series?
Yeah, there's no doubt. Much like the Rays, this has been a very resilient Dodger team this year. People counted them out of the race in April when the Diamondbacks in their division started out 21-9. Keep in mind, this team was a 500 team, you know, in August, and yet they turned it on from there. Joe Torre has a great touch with players. He never panics, and I really believe when the manager panics, the players take on the personality of the manager, and they start to panic. But when Joe Torre just looks and says, look, we're okay, we're coming back here, I fully expect them to come back, and I think this will be a series before it's done.
And I guess the Dodgers are going to be helped in a big way by Manny Ramirez, who seems to be swinging a very, very hot bat, as he often does in the postseason.
Right. And, Anthony, this story of Manny Ramirez is one of the best I've ever seen. Here he plays so poorly at the end for the Red Sox. It appears he wasn't even trying at the end with the Red Sox. And then he hit nearly 400 since he went to the Dodgers and has been the best hitter in the National League Championship Series through two games. That's how well he's swinging the bat again, and I just can't wait to see what he does when he's at home. And he's going to have to do something big because, again, the Dodgers will be in trouble if they don't do something at home.
That's Tim Kirkjian. He covers Major League Baseball for ESPN. Thanks again, Tim.
Thanks very much, Anthony.
The performance of the national anthem before every Major League Baseball game began during World War II. Today, non-traditional versions of the song have become relatively common, from Marvin Gaye's to Roseanne Barr's. But in 1968, a young, up-and-coming performer created the first uproar over a controversial rendition of the Star-Spangled Banner. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
The 1968 World Series pitted the Detroit Tigers against the defending champions, the St. Louis Cardinals. Legendary Detroit play-by-play man Ernie Harwell moonlighted as a songwriter in the 1960s. Because of his musical talents, the Tigers' front office asked him to pick the performers who would sing the national anthem before games 3, 4, and 5 of the series at Tiger Stadium. Harwell's choice for game 3 was Detroit native Margaret Whiting, who did a traditional version.
And for the second game, I picked Marvin Gaye for Motown. And one of the ironies of the whole situation was that the Tigers asked me to go to Marvin Gaye and ask him not to sing the song in a non-traditional way. And he agreed, and he sang it pretty straight. And the third choice was Jose Feliciano.
Jose Feliciano has recorded dozens of albums in both English and Spanish. His Christmas song, Feliz Navidad, is ubiquitous between Thanksgiving and New Year's. But in 1968, he was a newcomer, and his cover of The Doors' song, Light My Fire, was a hit.
The time for hesitation's through. There's no time to wallow in the mire.
On October 7th, 1968, 23-year-old Jose Feliciano played the Star-Spangled Banner at Tiger Stadium, strumming an acoustic guitar while he sang. Last 1968 was a turbulent time for the nation. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy had been assassinated. The country was at war in Vietnam. And Detroit was still recovering from the 1967 riots that left more than 40 dead and 2,000 buildings burned to the ground. Feliciano says many people assumed his version of the anthem was meant to convey a political message, but that was not his intention.
My feeling at the time was it was my way of thanking America for the great opportunities that I had been given. The fact that a Puerto Rican kid could become successful, I love this country, and as far as I'm concerned, it's the greatest country in the world.
Harwell escorted Feliciano, who has been blind since birth, and his seeing eye dog off the field.
And he asked me on the way toward the stands, how did I do? I said, I think you did fine. And I was surprised by the reaction, and the New York Times had a front page picture of Jose singing, and which was rather unusual for the Times in those days. Now, the Tigers got quite a few letters, and I got about 500 and something letters, and most of them were against, but there was a good representation of pro letters among the group.
Tigers outfielder Willie Horton says Feliciano's performance caught the players, including Detroit pitcher Mickey Lolich, off guard. But Horton also considered it the team's good luck charm.
I remember Lolich looked and said, wow, what? Wow. We never heard anything like that, but I think you could feel something. It got the fans ready for the game, and which we needed. I just look at it back at that time. It was a turning point. To me, a lot of electricity was going through the fans.
St. Louis had taken a 3-1 lead in the series. The Tigers won Game 5 and then beat the Cardinals twice more in St. Louis to clinch the title. The New York Times reported that NBC received hundreds of complaints from television viewers who saw Feliciano's performance. Some commentators called the version Baby Light My Flag, playing off Feliciano's success with Light My Fire. Looking back, Feliciano says he's proud to be the first to take an unusual approach to the national anthem.
Or during that whole era of the 60s, the anthem was sung very traditional. And the people who went to the ball game were very bored with it, and they couldn't wait till whoever sang it got to the end so they could get on with the game. And I thought this was unconscionable, that this was horrible. It was a shame that our anthem had to be treated so poorly.
Feliciano's rendition came 10 months before Jimi Hendrix performed his now famous version at Woodstock. Despite, or maybe because of the controversy, Feliciano's was the first to make it to the charts as a single, but he says the uproar hurt his career.
Radio stations all over the country stopped playing my records. Even though I won Grammys that year, Best Performance by a Male Vocalist and Best New Artist, from 1968 to 1973, I was gone from the airwaves.
Ernie Harwell, now 90 years old, says Feliciano's World Series performance is still his favorite version of the song.
I think most people who hear it now would say, well, what was all the fuss about? Because it was a soul rendition, all right. It had a lot of feeling. It had some blues in it. But I never thought it was denigrating in any way, like a lot of people did.
Jose Feliciano is still performing and recording albums. He says despite the controversy, given another chance, he would still sing it the same way.
I think America is one of those countries that is willing to say, hey, you know what? We were wrong. This is not right. Let's change it. And so that's why I love America. That's why I did the national anthem. And I will always be a patriot. And nobody can ever say about Jose Feliciano that he's un-American.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
For the land and for the free and the home of the brave. Yeah.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Ian Williams is something of a hero these days in the town of Pontlu, outside Surrey, England. With his soccer team locked in a 1-1 tie with its local rival, Williams could only watch helplessly from the bench because of a broken foot. But with time running out, Williams ripped off his cast and hobbled onto the field as a sub. Within a minute, he had the ball, and with his fractured foot, he drilled it into the back of the opponent's net for the winning goal. Said the 29-year-old Williams, "I couldn't believe it. It hurt really bad the minute I struck it." After that winning shot, Williams was forced to leave the field for the final 2 minutes. It seems he was overcome by pain and, after spending most of the game drinking beer, by nausea. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, director Gary Fleeter joins me to discuss his new movie, The Express, the Ernie Davis story. But first, the LA Times' Helene Elliott is on the line to preview the brand new NHL season, which opened this week. Welcome back, Helene.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the Detroit Red Wings, who lost their first game of the regular season this past week. Did the defending Stanley Cup champions do enough in the offseason to prepare for another title run?
I thought it was actually kind of funny that Toronto beat them in that opener because Toronto has a new coach in Ron Wilson, and he had been getting into it a little bit with the Toronto media. So now he can say that he's got a perfect record. I think for him, it's all downhill from there. It's tough. People don't realize how tough it is to win the Stanley Cup and come back after a short summer and try and do it all over again. I mean, we're talking 82 pretty grueling games. You're talking, you know, a long playoff run with a lot of overtime games. I mean, the Red Wings Penguin series was terrific, and you know, even though the Red Wings won, it certainly wasn't easy. So there's a lot of effort that goes into it. You know, during the summer, you're parading the cup around, and everybody gets it for a day, and nobody's quite inclined to go work out when you've got the Stanley Cup in town. So it takes a lot of discipline for players to get through the summer and be ready. I think the difference with Detroit is that they're so deep and they're so good. I would say that they could win the Cup again, but it's going to be a difficult road for them.
Well, speaking of the Red Wings and their depth, this summer the Red Wings re-signed Chris Chelios, who almost unbelievably returns for his 25th NHL season. He's a 46-year-old defenseman, but he's out for a few weeks with a fractured shin bone. Will he be able to help Detroit this year?
You know, people have been saying for the last 10 years that he's finished, and he keeps proving people wrong. You know, he's not going to play big minutes. He's probably not going to play power play or really, you know, crucial situations. But when you have someone like him who's got such experience, he can use his head and his anticipation of plays and various things that come with experience. He can use that when, you know, the head can do a little bit what the legs won't do anymore.
Now, a lot of NHL observers feel that the Dallas Stars will be the Red Wings' toughest Western Conference opponent. Do you agree with that?
Well, I was thinking that the Anaheim Ducks might be able to give them a little bit of a run there, but Anaheim did not do very well in its opener against San Jose. You know, the Ducks had a difficult season last year as the defending champions. Two of their key players, Teemu Selänne and Scott Niedermayer, didn't start the season with them last year. Both of them retired very briefly. Both of them came back during the season, and it was a very unsettled season for the Ducks. And the thing they kept saying throughout training camp this year was that, okay, everybody's here. We, you know, Teemu's in camp from day one, and Scotty knows that he wants to play, so we should be in good shape. And then they went out in their opener against San Jose, and they were just awful. It was like nobody showed up. It's a very tough division, the Pacific Division, and a very tough conference, the Western Conference. You know, people say, oh, only one game. You can't judge anything off one game, and that's certainly true. But in this conference, every game is going to be so crucial that to play as badly as they did in their opener and leave the 2 points out there could hurt them later.
In the Eastern Conference, the Pittsburgh Penguins came within 2 games of winning it all last season. And I'm wondering if a more experienced Sidney Crosby, the team's young phenom, could help the Pens make it back to the finals. What do you think?
The team that loses the Cup the following season has always had a very difficult time. I think the Penguins are going to be able to avoid that, but they also have some problems in that two of their key players are injured. Sergei Gonchar, their defenseman, splendid defenseman who ran the power play, he's injured. And Ryan Whitney is injured. And they lost a lot of goal scoring when the two free agents left over the summer. Ryan Malone left and Marian Hossa left. And they're going to be very hard-pressed to make that up. Of course, Sidney Crosby, I think, could carry the entire city strapped to his back if he needed to. But I'm curious to see how they respond, because this is a situation that none of them has ever been in before. You know, they also had a very long season and a very short summer. And although they're a very young team, you wonder how they're going to respond this season now that there's so many more expectations that they have to carry.
Meanwhile, the Montreal Canadiens look to build upon their strong performance from last season. What do the Habs have to do to win back that gleaming chalice that most Quebecois view as theirs?
I think that they're counting a lot on their goaltender, Carey Price, who's very young. But the kid seems to not feel pressure. He really developed very, very well last season. it would be amazing if the Canadians do win the Cup, as a lot of people think that they will. I mean, this is the 100th anniversary of their franchise, and they have a lot of different ceremonies and events planned to commemorate that. And, you know, when you've won as many Stanley Cups as they do, they know how to do ceremonies. They know how to do things like that. And it's going to be a terrific season in that regard, just to watch all these great former players come out and celebrate the anniversary with them. And it's going to be an event just about every night with that team.
And what other Eastern or Western Conference teams merit discussion? Did we leave any out?
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see what Ottawa does. They had a core of players that have been together for a little while, and they haven't won. They lost to the Ducks in the final in 2007. And I think that if they don't win it this season, that there could really be a complete breakup of that team. They have a new coach this season, Craig Hartsburg, and it's going to be a difficult season for them if they don't get out of the gate really quickly. You know, in the West, a lot of people are looking at San Jose and going, okay, they've lost in the second round of the playoffs the last 3 years. I'm not going to pick them again. I don't know. This may be the one time you can pick them, although they have a new coach, Todd McClellan, and he's tried to change things a little bit, and people seem to be resistant to change, but they did very, very well in their opener, so that may give the coach a little bit of early credibility, like, gee, he must know what he's talking about.
That's Helene Elliott. She covers the NHL for the Los Angeles Times, and she joins us here on Only a Game from time to time. Thanks, Helene.
Thank you.
The season just got underway. We got 3 wins in a row. Not only were they victories, they didn't score a goal. We weren't thinking of a winning streak, just thinking of a win. That is how our greatest season started to begin.
In his day, he was known as the Elmira Express. He was Ernie Davis, a fleet-footed running back from Elmira, New York. He was recruited by Syracuse University and led the Orange Men to their only national championship in 1959. And in 1961, Ernie Davis became the first black player to win the Heisman Trophy. Now a new movie called The Express, the Ernie Davis story, tells the story of this young athlete and pioneer. In this scene, Davis, played by actor Rob Brown, and his coach, Ben Schwartzwalder, played by Dennis Quaid, are greeted by an angry mob and a couple of reporters before the Cotton Bowl in Texas in 1959.
This is quite a ruckus.
Hey, Ernie, Roger Page, Channel 9. They're calling this game the North against the South. In light of what's going on in this country, do you feel added pressure to represent change?
We don't concern ourselves with politics. We're just here to play a great football game and take home a championship.
To be honest, Mr. Page, when I'm out on that field, I only think about winning the game. But that doesn't mean I don't know the color of my own skin.
That's Dennis Quaid and Rob Brown, who has the lead role in the new movie, The Express, the Ernie Davis story. And joining us now from the studios of NPR West is Gary Fleeter. He's the director of the movie, and welcome to Only a Game, Gary.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Now, Gary, in that clip we just heard, you get a sense of the enormous pressure that faced this college football star. Remind us what it was like for a black college athlete in 1959. What was Ernie Davis up against?
Well, I think you're up against the culture. That sounds obvious, but I think there was a microcosmic thing happening in college sports. You had the fact that there were some schools in the Northeast, like Syracuse, that were liberal, that were recruiting black players. There were 3 black players the year Ernie played, himself, John Brown, and Art Baker. But a lot of other schools, including the Longhorns, who they played at Dallas, and also West Virginia, the Mountaineers, had no black players at all.
And the attitudes were pretty tough. That clip we played told part of the story about the 1959 Cotton Bowl, which Syracuse won. But I guess Ernie Davis, as you depict in the film, and the other black athletes on the Syracuse team weren't even allowed through the hotel front door where their teammates played, right?
Yeah, and also as John Brown, who Jack Buckley's based on in the movie, played by Omar Benson Miller. I mean, John Brown recently spoke about that, the idea that he and the black players had to stay in a little room behind the kitchen in the hotel. And Jim Brown, who, of course, came before Ernie Davis at Syracuse in the mid-50s, had the same treatment when they played the Cotton Bowl in 56. So, I mean, there was definitely this thing happening. And, you know, the movie's really also about the idea of the coach Ben Schwartzwalder, who was in a way, he was colorblind, but in some way he was also abiding by the culture. And that's what the movie's dealing with, is the idea that the arc of the film is really more about this coach than about Ernie himself.
Let's play a clip about the coach, played by Dennis Quaid. In this scene, Ernie Davis is talking to Schwartzwalder about the fact that he's been given jersey number 44, which was the number worn by Jim Brown, who also played at Syracuse. Let's listen to a minute.
It's this jersey, coach.
What, something wrong with it?
Yeah, I
what is it? Too big? Too tight? What?
Oh, no, not at all. It's just...
Well, then what is it?
Somebody made a mistake. They gave me the wrong number.
Mr. Davis, I put that jersey in your locker. Are you accusing me of making a mistake?
No, sir.
Well, then what?
Coach, I'm not Jim Brown.
God, I hope not. And God, I hope so. That is your number. The day you're not up to it, I'll take it away as quick as a hiccup. Now get out of here.
That's Dennis Quaid, who plays Syracuse coach Ben Schwartzwalder, and Rob Brown, who has the title role in the new movie The Express, the Ernie Davis story. Gary, tell us a little more about Ben Schwartzwalder. As you depict him, he's, of course, one of Ernie Davis's biggest supporters, but you suggested before that clip that he, too, was struggling with racial attitudes of his time, right?
Well, he was, but he was also a pioneer. I think the film does not depict him as racist at all. There have been some comments to that effect, but I think it's not fair. I think Ben was a man of his time. He had fought in the war, in World War II. He was at Normandy. He was from West Virginia. So there was definitely a cultural context where he came from, where he went to school. But he also was liberal in the sense that he was recruiting black players back to 1951 with a guy named Avetus Stone, who was a black quarterback that came before Jim Brown. Now, that said, there's great evidence that that Ben was a man of his time, and that he was in a way, he wasn't necessarily supporting the culture of bias, but he certainly was abiding by it. And you know, it's absolutely true that he told Jim Brown and told Ernie Davis that maybe they shouldn't date white girls on campus, that it might not seem right. And there were things going on, like in Dallas, where in fact the black players were, you know, segregated. So there are things going on that I think there's a complexity to it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think the challenge for Dennis Quaid was, as I said to him, never apologize for being this guy. You know, I didn't want to, as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, want Dennis or myself, I didn't want to do the condescending, simplistic version of race. I felt this was a much more complicated film to deal with the idea of covert racism, not overt racism.
No, it's true. And he wasn't depicted as an overt racist at all. And I agree with you. I don't think he came across as a racist. But another scene that was troubling, or at least sort of revealed a complexity, is he actually pulls Ernie Davis off the field in a game in West Virginia, even though that was sort of, you know, a sure way to win by keeping Ernie Davis on the field. And the reason he pulled Ernie Davis off the field was he didn't want to provoke a race riot if he scored another touchdown.
Well, that scene's reflective of, again, that's just fact. A lot of great black athletes were, in fact, not even allowed to play at all. Sometimes in certain schools, certain games down south, because they didn't want to incite, you know, engender any sort of blowback. That scene is reflective of a much bigger thing that was going on in the 50s and into the 60s. So, yeah, I mean, it's an ugly scene, but it's also indicating what was sort of a bigger problem with the sports. And again, I think that it's important to look at the movie in context of the civil rights movement is heating up in the mid and late 50s. There's that sort of interesting quiet time people don't know about, don't talk about as much, because they refer to the mid-late 60s of, you know, fire hoses and guard dogs. And there's this interesting period, you know, post-Rosa Parks, that I really found compelling. Martin Luther King, his rise, and that sort of quieter protest that was happening, the sit-ins, the boycotts.
I'm talking with Gary Fleeter, director of The Express, the Ernie Davis story, and you're listening to Only a Game. I wanted to let you know, I wanted to sort of just get you to respond to a reaction I saw to your film when I saw it in Boston last week. I attended it with a large group of, I think they were high school kids. They were all black from a neighborhood in Boston. They were all wearing their football jerseys. they just ate this movie up. I mean, they just loved it. There were cheers, not just at the sort of heroics on the grid, but all of the ways in which the Ernie Davis character was confronting the sort of regressive racial attitudes of his time. What do you make of that? I mean, how does that make you feel?
I'm really happy to hear that. When I was a kid growing up in the 70s, films like Rocky and Breaking Away, I remember seeing Rocky as a kid and cheering and standing up when he was knocking Apollo Creed around the ring. I remember, being on my feet as a kid, and I look back and I think I'm cheering a movie. It's not a live event, not that even they can hear it in a live event, but I remember having that feeling of that collective sense of hypnosis of being in a live sporting event. So I didn't know if we'd have that or not. And the first preview we had in Burbank, California, about a year ago, and that happened, where the audience came in, they knew nothing about the film, about the story. It was an early, early on period. And during the big cotton ball sequence, which is a big part of the second act, they were vocal and they were cheering, and there's a couple of really big plays with Ernie, and it was kind of one of those extraordinary moments where everyone was together. And as the studio said to me, the film is now playing not only as a movie, but also as a live sporting event.
So we need to talk about the sad ending of this story. Not surprisingly, Ernie Davis was drafted by the NFL, ending up with a contract with the Cleveland Browns, but he never gets to play. Tell us what happened.
Ernie Davis got sick. He collapsed during a practice of an All-Star game before going to the NFL, and he thought he had a gum problem or a tooth problem with some molars, and it turns out that he had monocytic leukemia.
Hmm.
And at the time, I think that was now I think it's much more treatable and you can mitigate, but I think back then it was certainly not a good prognosis.
Well, Gary Fleeter, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Gary Fleeter. He's the director of The Express, the Ernie Davis story. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After 20 years of scrounging scrap steel, metal cookware, and old bicycles, two farmers from Tangshan, China, recently completed construction on their own Formula One racing car. I guess you could call this a case of high-speed recycling. Zhao Jishun and Zhao Baoguo say they built their sleek racer, which has a top speed of 100 miles per hour, entirely from materials they found around their farm. Their inspiration? Their late father, a truck driver, who told them it's no big deal to drive, but it's quite something to build a car. I'm Anthony Brooks, sitting in for the vacationing Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we'll meet several athletes that could accurately be described as strong as oxen. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with a week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Anthony. Good to see you.
Okay, so there are two big college football matchups today, Charlie. At noon Eastern, number 5 Texas will host their arch rivals, number 1 Oklahoma. I'm sure the fans in Dallas will extend a warm welcome to the Sooners.
Yeah, this is of course one of those epic games where everybody goes out at 8 o'clock in the morning, walks to the Texas State Fair, and eats a bunch of corn dogs before the game. They're both in the top 5 for the first time in 2004. This is a real chance for Texas to get back in the national championship picture. I think I'm going to go with the home team. I think Texas is going to beat them.
All right. And tonight, number 11, Florida, hosts number 4, LSU. Should be an interesting game, but let's hope LSU's offensive line doesn't deliver on its promise.
They always do this. There's always some idiot who announces that he's going to hurt the star of the other team. LSU defensive tackle Ricky Jean-Francois. With a name like that, he would not be playing football at Michigan, I would point out. Anyway, young Mr. Ricky Jean-Francois from Baton Rouge has decided that he's going to take his best shot and try to take out Tim Tebow of Florida, the quarterback and the defending Heisman Trophy winner. You know, if you are going to be that kind of football player, just do it. Don't announce it like a day beforehand. People will just look for you now.
The Miami Dolphins beat the New England Patriots and San Diego Chargers in their last two games. No one expected much from this team, which features, among other players, a running back with a laser arm. So my question is, will Ronnie Brown help them contend for the AFC East title?
Let's put this in words that football coaches can understand.
Okay, good. Because we have a lot of them out there listening.
If this direct snap thing works again, every defensive coordinator in the NFL should be fired because they're all morons. It's now worked 2 weeks in a row. If he's in position to get the snap, chances are he's going to get it.
Okay, one more note about football. Adam Pac-Man Jones will play for Dallas tomorrow despite a recent dust-up that could have voided his contract with the Cowboys. But I guess there was no specific language, Charlie, about fighting with one's own bodyguard in the bathrooms of glitzy hotels?
Nor should there be. Fisticuffs among the entourage should be beyond the reach of the law.
I thought a bodyguard served a different purpose.
Well, you're paying for the guy. I mean, maybe he's trying to protect him from himself.
Okay, Major League Baseball. Fox broadcaster Tim McCarver recently criticized Manny Ramirez for tanking it while he was with Boston and magically transforming into a composite of Babe Ruth, Hank Aaron, and Ted Williams after he was traded to Los Angeles. Are you excited about the possibility of, and I say the possibility, of a Dodgers-Red Sox World Series matchup?
Well, yeah, because Manny Ramirez is not the only storyline in that matchup. J.D. Drew would be returning to Los Angeles, where he's held in approximately the same esteem that Manny Ramirez is in Boston right now. Derek Lowe, one of the heroes of the Red Sox 2004 stretch drive, back in Fenway. Nomar Garciaparra returning to Fenway for a World Series, even though he isn't getting much playing time. That would be, if you want easy columns, if you're a columnist wanting easy columns, that's the treasure of Sierra Madre.
Okay, moving on to the NBA. Los Angeles Clippers GM Elgin Baylor has decided to resign after 22 years on the job. Some argue that the 74-year-old Hall of Famer, who reportedly had been stripped of any real authority to run the team, is not being treated with due respect, given the Clippers' record over the last two-plus decades. Do you agree with that argument?
He probably isn't being treated well, but he should have been fired 15 years ago. So, I mean, I'm not exactly sure where they're supposed to go. Give him the gold watch. Respect the fact that he's a Hall of Famer for what he did on the court, but he was not a very good general manager, and this is something that's way, way overdue.
Mm. The skates have been sharpened. The Zamboni parade has rumbled off into the sunset, which means the NHL season is underway. How do you like the Philadelphia Flyers promotional event before tonight's game against the Rangers, which features a certain hockey mom?
Anthony, I'm not going to answer that question the way you want me to. I'm going to speak directly to the American people.
And talk about what? Agricultural.
And you betcha I'm going to talk about Sarah Palin coming to drop the puck, palling around with Ed Snyder, sugar daddy to many wingnut causes. Oh, you betcha I'm going to point out that building was built with public funds, at least some of which came from people who think Sarah Palin is, you know, maybe not up to the job, but that was a gotcha question, Anthony. I don't want any more of those.
So it might be a political event in which a hockey game will break out, possibly.
Yeah. One can only hope, you know?
Speaking of the Flyers, they finished their preseason with a loss, which might not have been so bad except when you consider to whom they lost.
Yeah, this is a terrific thing, actually. They lost to their AHL franchise, their minor league franchise, the Philadelphia Phantoms, excuse me if I just spit on you, 4-2. This is, I think, a great way to build, like, franchise-wide camaraderie. And, you know, I suspect that next year, if these two teams play again, the Flyers will probably win about 15-1.
Charlie, the mice of the PGA Tour have been playing with unusual glee while the cat, specifically Tiger, has been away. How do you think they took Tiger Woods' declaration this week that he'll be better than ever when he returns next year?
I think everybody will believe him, which will make them shake a little bit. Most athletes would say that. He's one of the few that when he says after a year off and a serious knee operation he's going to be better, you believe him. He's come out quite a bit this week. He's opened a new golf course. He's done this interview with Reuters. He did the Today Show. He's folding back into his public personality very smoothly.
And, Charlie, the world of NASCAR racing was marred somewhat this week by a scuffle among two of its top 12 drivers and controversy over defective tires at last week's race. Will NASCAR patch things up before the Cup Chase season ends?
NASCAR's a very underrated sport for athletes beating on each other. So hockey gets all the criticism.
All the glory.
The occasional baseball fight is sprawling but boring. But there's a lot of really good NASCAR fights. I mean, Carl Edwards and Kevin Harvick is a really good fight, especially in the garage where there's like stuff to grab and swing. You could turn it into a Schwarzenegger movie.
Charlie, I love this story. Roane State Community College bolstered its men's basketball roster with a 6-foot senior guard who, at the very least, will add a certain veteran presence. Do I have that right?
Kenny Mink, 73 years old, a semi-retired journalist, which I sympathize with, being one myself. I'm rooting for him in a big way because that's pretty much what I am, too. But the great thing about him is that his career ended in 1956. He was playing at junior college, and he was dismissed, and he says unfairly and wrongly, for soaping the coach's office with shaving cream. You talk about a more innocent time, but he's going to come back now. He's been knocking down shots in his driveway. He's going to have a terrific time, and I, for one, hope they put the game on ESPN.
Finally, Charlie, 29-year-old Holly Budge conquered Mount Everest on Sunday. Women have certainly done that before, except Budge became the first to do so in an unusual fashion.
Yeah, she did it the other direction. She came out of the sky to the mountain. She jumped at 29,500 feet and landed 12,350 feet up the mountain. But my point is, if you're still 12,000 feet above sea level, can you honestly be said to have landed?
So we're talking about someone who jumped out of an airplane with a parachute
jumped
on her back.
Jumped out of an airplane with a parachute and landed on Mount Everest.
Unbelievable. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Anthony.
To visit Only a Game's magical web world, please go to onlyagame.org. And now, a sport that's rich in tradition that involves tremendous feats of strength. We must be talking about weightlifting, right? Wrong. Sumo wrestling, then. Wrong again. But here's a hint. That's right, oxen pulling. The chosen sport of farmers and loggers for the past 200 years in the U.S., particularly here in the Northeast. It turns out that oxen pulling is still thriving here at the Topsfield Fair, America's oldest agricultural fair, about 25 miles north of Boston. Earlier this week, we spent some time with the men and women who drive these large beasts. And we mean large.
I mean, I'm standing next to this guy. Is huge. I mean, he is taller. I mean, I'm 5'9", and his shoulder is, what, 6 feet high here?
I'm looking up. It's over my head.
It's over your head, yeah.
This is a massive grayish-white Chianina ox, which comes from Italy. It's among the biggest, weighing more than 3,000 pounds. According to Bill Elliott, the superintendent of ox and horse pull competition here at Topsfield.
A couple that we did weigh this morning, just for the fun of it, were 6,600 pounds a pair. And one of them was 33-something, ton and a half.
Better. So big animals.
Alan Rainville uses a wire brush to clean the mud off the hindquarters of an ox just before the competition. Rainville has a craggy, weather-beaten face and looks like he's been around this sport for a long time.
So how long have you been working with oxen?
With me? Yeah. Since I was 13 years old.
Yeah. So this guy is huge.
I've been coming to Topsfield Fair since 1964.
So what does it take to make a champion ox? Is it just strength, or is there something more that
You got to have strength. You got to have a good driver, a good athlete. If they didn't have a good manager, what would they be? They got to have it between their ears, too. Right, Harry?
Bill Elliott, the oxen pull superintendent at Topsfield, agrees. He says this sport requires both animal and human intelligence.
It's the driver, because the driver has to get them in the right position so that they're both starting off on the right foot and that they start together. And if one pulls and the other doesn't, they're not going to go anywhere. So they both need to be going at the same time and in the same direction. And that's where you can separate the drivers out.
When we arrived at Topsfield, most of the drivers were busy preparing their animals for competition, harnessing them together in pairs with big, heavy wooden yokes. These huge animals have names like Diesel, Hemi, Turbo, and Charlie. Most of them are raised and trained solely for competitions like this, but Bill Elliott says some oxen still do real work.
Some might on an occasion, but you know, not for plowing like they used to, or for moving logs. Occasionally they will use them for moving logs on an area where you don't want to disturb the soil. Getting a tractor in there or a skidder, log skidder, you can see that they do a lot of damage to the property that need to be repaired. And oxen would be fairly neat, so they wouldn't leave as much of a footprint.
So they're just about to start here. I'm in the arena now, and I'm looking at 9 oxen teams. That's 9 pairs of oxen. And they're just getting this big sled ready that carries big concrete blocks. And let's talk to a couple of the contestants who are here. Tell me your name.
Kim Patton.
Kim Patton, where are you from, Kim?
Springfield, New Hampshire.
So tell me what we need to understand about this competition. First of all, why do you like it?
Just a hobby that we do in the summer times, go to the fairs.
And then if you win, you get to retire early and move to Florida, right?
No, you just make whatever the premiums are at each fair.
Right. I guess what I was getting at is it's a labor of love. You're not doing this for the money, right?
That's right.
In fact, the biggest cash prize is only $350, which doesn't even cover the feed or the fuel to truck these animals in. Bill Powell is here with his oxen team from Canton, Massachusetts. He says he still uses his animals for real work, like clearing brush and logging.
Nice taking a pair of cattle that don't know anything and, you know, teaching them how to work. And
do they like working? I know some working animals, you know, you can tell that they like to work.
Yeah, the good ones do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just like it. So I wish mine liked it a little more.
The rules of the competition are pretty straightforward. A metal sled is piled with concrete blocks weighing 600 pounds each. The drivers have 3 chances to coax and whip the animals to get them to pull the sled 6 feet without pausing. The starting load is about 3,000 pounds, which all the teams handle with ease. Then more weight is added, and the teams begin to falter. The oxen pull and strain, their muscles tensing and swelling under their smooth hides.
There's a lot of skill in getting them to do what they have to do.
That's Bob Allen, a contest judge. He says there are rules about how to treat the animals. No whipping on the face, for example, and only 2 lashes on their backs after they start pulling. Allen says it's important to keep this tradition alive.
Yeah, I think it is, because as the country grows in population and more places become developed, the family farm and things like this are being crowded out. And I think it's important to show that there is still a lot of interest in the agricultural side of the United States.
In terms of excitement and popularity, oxen pulling isn't about to displace NASCAR racing. But Steve Bryant from Weymouth, Massachusetts, was happy to be here.
It's not like a racetrack or something where you see the cars go around or the motorcycles. Not that kind of excitement, but just to watch the animals do what they do, and it's pretty impressive.
The load is 5,800 pounds.
And some of these fans are pretty knowledgeable. Jack Sanborn used to own oxen and came all the way from St. Albans, Maine to watch the event. He says there's a lot involved in raising and training these animals.
Well, you got to start them really young. You can put a yoke on them a couple days after they're born, and you start working with them.
And if you're going to train them to pull, as they get older, you have to keep putting more and more weight behind them. You got to work on them every day. If you want to really compete with the big boys, you got there's a lot of time has to be put into them.
Get over here, get over here.
Finally, 2 hours on, the load is about 6,000 pounds, and all the teams have pulled out except for the one owned by Mike Audette from Connecticut. Audette is a regular winner on the oxen pulling circuit and claimed a trophy and the $200 prize.
You just won in there.
Yeah.
So congratulations.
All right.
Audette is a large man with huge forearms and a suntan face. But like a lot of athletes, he's focused on his sport, or in this case, his oxen. And, well, he uses his word sparingly.
How come you guys won?
We pulled the heaviest load. You got to go 6 feet.
And I hear you're often the one to beat in there.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. How do you make your oxen so strong?
Luck, I guess.
You don't feed them a lot of spinach or something
no.
like that. Like we said, a man of few words. That's Mike Audette. He and his oxen, Turbo and Charlie, won the 3,300-pound class oxen pull earlier this week at the Topsfield Fair in Topsfield, Massachusetts. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Erica Bailey, Jim Kiesling, David Davis, and Danelle Alexander. Our senior producer is Gary Wallet. If you'd like to view our oxen pulling photo gallery, download our weekly podcast, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from oxen pulling fan Bob Wyatt, who explains the difficulties oxen drivers occasionally experience with their teams.
Sometimes they can be mighty stubborn.
Like an ox?
Right, right.
To think otherwise, you'd have to be blind as a bat or dull as a butternut. I'm Anthony Brooks. Thanks for listening. Bill Littlefield returns next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.